and we're following the latest out of Nice, France, where officials are investigating the attack on a Bastille Day celebration last night by a Tunisian-born resident of the city who plowed into crowds of people with a truck. He killed at least 84. The French prosecutor said that Mohamed Bolel was known to police for petty crime, but not for terrorism.
On the other hand, he was entirely unknown by the intelligence services. Whether nationally or locally, he had never been the subject of any kind of file or indication of radicalization.
And French President François Hollande was booed as his convoy drove through Nice today. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us now from her cell phone from the streets of Nice. Eleanor, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Peter.
And you're right there, I gather, right where it all happened. Is there still anything to see today?
Yes, there is. I'm right where the beach is. There's a big boulevard, a pedestrian boulevard, and a street right behind the beach. It's called the Promenade des Anglais, and that's where it happened last night. And today it's blocked off, so you can see the beautiful, glittering blue Mediterranean and the beach and the umbrellas, but you can't go. It's a crime scene now. This morning, the police and people in hazmat uniforms were picking up evidence and had baby carriages, and tonight they seem to be gone, but there's still police keeping people out, and people have laid, you know, flowers at the barricades, and people are just coming to gaze out on the scene of where the driver, you know, plowed through the crowd last night, killing 84 people.
Yeah, and there was a press conference today where police described what kind of weapons were involved inside of that truck and how exactly Bolel carried out the attack. Did we learn anything else significant?
Well, what we learned basically is some of those weapons were fake, and he just had a handgun where he shot at the police, but he did the damage really with the car. And, you know, I went actually to a neighborhood in the north of Nice today, sort of public housing, high-rise buildings, not a bad place, and we talked to people who knew him and especially knew his wife and children and sort of his family, his brother and, you know, his wife's family. And they said, you know, they said maybe this was wishful thinking, but they said this was not a terrorist attack. This guy was a bad guy. He beat his wife. Hmm. You know, his wife's family was good. And they seemed to all want to believe that this was not a terrorist attack, even though it looks like it because it was on France's National Day, Bastille Day. And, you know, but it's true. A lot of the guns in there were fake grenades. So. Yeah. People pointed out today, they said if that was ISIS, he'd have had real weapons.
And what are French officials saying about any potential links to terrorist groups abroad? I mean, at first glance, it looks like there were none, but we just don't know yet.
No, we don't know yet. And François Molins, the Paris prosecutor, terrorism investigator, was handling this case. They're looking into that now. And he said, you know, basically, we're looking, perhaps there was an accomplice, perhaps not. They're looking at all that right now. He says it's just too early to tell.
Hmm. Well, you were in the neighborhood, as you mentioned, where the suspect lived or his family or friends lived. British security expert Peter Neumann says that Nice has been a jihadist breeding ground for years. And I just wonder, is Nice plagued by the same kind of problems that we've heard about in other French cities, especially the suburbs around Paris with some of these other attacks?
I think it's different. Well, it's a sunny place, and it's kind of just totally different from the gray high-rises around Paris, and they don't seem to be so far from, you know, it's at the beach, so first of all, it just seems like a better place to be, but it's nearer Tunisia, it's on the Mediterranean, Tunisia, Algeria, these North African countries are across the Mediterranean. There is a large, probably, Arab population. They probably are disaffected. The mayor, who's now a regional councillor, he's had a lot of, you know, he's said, you know, let's say negative things about Islamists. And I think, you know, there is contention. And I heard French newscasters talking about more than 100 people from Nice have gone to join jihadist ranks in Syria and Iraq. So that's a lot. So there is some contention here between, you know, people maybe radicalizing and then the regular population. But, you know, when you see the place, the people we talked to today were probably a good many of them Muslim, but they said, we're just regular people. We work our jobs in the working class neighborhood, and he was just bad news, but he was just a bad guy. So I don't know. It's hard to know, but yes, there are these problems with disaffected Muslim, young Muslim men mostly.
And the irony, of course, is that just hours before this attack, President Hollande announced that the state of emergency restrictions would be lifted after this month. But, of course, they are now back in place. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley of NPR joining us from Nice, France. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
We go to domestic politics now and the race for the White House. Today, Republican Donald Trump made the announcement. He sent out a tweet saying he's asked Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, to be his running mate. Trump says he'll make it all official tomorrow. Hillary Clinton has yet to announce her running mate. Over the past 100 years, some American vice presidents have played a crucial role, but you could call others seat fillers. To talk about the job of vice president, we turn to Alan Lichtman. He is a distinguished professor of history at American University. Good to have you with us.
My great pleasure.
We know how important the vice president is intended to be. In reality, though, how critical is the person in that role?
Traditionally, the vice president has been largely irrelevant in presidential administrations. But in modern times, that has really changed.
Starting when?
Perhaps the man who brought the vice presidency into the modern era was Walter Mondale, Jimmy Carter's vice president. He was the first vice president to have an office in the West Wing of the White House. He was an extremely important advisor in policies such as the Panama Canal treaties, Jimmy Carter's energy policies. He extensively traveled the world on behalf of the Carter administration. Since then, of course, Al Gore, Joe Biden, and Dick Cheney have been extremely influential in their respective presidential administrations.
And in terms of what they did, it seems to me that those people that you just mentioned have assumed very different roles. So they've almost molded the vice presidency in terms of their own interests, in terms of their own concerns.
That is a very important point. Dick Cheney's concern was, first of all, to put the Bush administration on a solidly conservative footing. And he was very influential in areas of his interest, particularly foreign and military policy. He was a major architect of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a major influence on domestic economic and energy policy. Al Gore was, of course, extremely interested in technology. You know, he boasted perhaps a little bit too much boastfully that he invented the internet, but he was certainly influential in that and was very important, of course, as an advocate for policy dealing with climate change.
And what about Joe Biden's imprint?
As we know, Barack Obama came into the presidency with very little experience and background in foreign policy. So he picked Joe Biden, a man with extensive experience in foreign policy on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. And Joe Biden has been his top advisor on matters of foreign policy.
In recent history, we have had two vice presidents become president under very difficult circumstances. LBJ became president after John Kennedy was assassinated. Gerald Ford took over when President Nixon resigned. How is a vice president able to navigate from being primed and ready to possibly assume the presidency and then carrying on his or her own interests and role in advising the president?
It is a very difficult thing to navigate, and you do have to make up your mind that when you are the vice president, you are subject to the president's will. Lyndon Johnson hated being vice president. And while he certainly had some important influence, was not a major player in the Kennedy administration. In fact, he was more powerful, in Caro's famous words, as the master of the Senate, as the majority leader of the United States Senate.
The journalist Robert Caro.
Yes, but he was absolutely ready and put his stamp on the presidency. Arguably, he is, along with Franklin Roosevelt, the most influential president in building the modern liberal state.
So the role is morphing, and I wonder how you think it might continue to morph under the next president and how important the vice presidential role will be.
Donald Trump is one of those enigmatic figures who's very difficult to pin down. He has no governmental experience, very little knowledge of public policy. And in that sense, the vice president could be an extremely important and influential advisor under Donald Trump. On the other hand, he doesn't take advice well, he doesn't listen well, and the vice president could be of no influence whatsoever under Donald Trump.
And Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton has vast governmental experience and will run her own administration, but I think she will listen to her vice president, and I think she will give her vice president some very specific policy roles, depending upon the identity, of course, of the particular pick.
Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University in Washington, D.C., thank you.
My pleasure.
Let's look at politics here in this country now. This week, there was a kind of casting call as Donald Trump considered various potential vice presidential picks. And finally today, in keeping with his attachment to Twitter, he sent out a tweet that his running mate is going to be Indiana's Governor Mike Pence.
And for more on the 2016 race, on a day that we're also following this terrorist attack in Nice, France, we've got Jesse Holland on the line. He's race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
Good. And we've also got Rebecca Sinderbrand, politics news editor for The Washington Post. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Rebecca, let's start with you. We'll get to the political fallout from Nice. But first, we were expecting this announcement from Donald Trump, and then we weren't. It got delayed because of the attacks. What do you make of Mike Pence as Trump's pick?
Well, you know, it's funny because we don't necessarily know the reason for the delay, because even as he delayed this announcement because of politics, because of the attack in Nice, Donald Trump went on to do a fundraiser last night and to make the announcement this morning anyway. You know, here's what we know about Mike Pence. The most important thing to remember, I think, and it's something that you have to wonder if it occurred to the Trump team beforehand, is much like the selection of Sarah Palin in 2008, he, in a sense, it undercuts some of the Trump campaign's arguments against Hillary Clinton. Mike Pence supports free trade. Mike Pence worked with expanding Medicare in his state under Obamacare. There are all kinds of areas that you can point to where he has policy differences with Donald Trump.
But
that's
is that an advantage, though, to have a person on the other side of the ticket who is more of an establishment kind of a guy?
It depends. If you are saying that it is critical for America that, you know, free trade agreements be scrapped and renegotiated, if you are saying it's critical that Obamacare be completely done away with, including every element of it, if you're saying that a Muslim ban is needed, something that a Muslim immigration ban is needed, something that Mike Pence has said is unnecessary and wrong. If you are on the stump saying it day after day and you are choosing as your running mate and a potential president someone who says the opposite, that's that raises some questions.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because Pence has said, in fact, back in December on Twitter, that calls to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. are offensive and unconstitutional. So he is not completely in line with Trump on all of the issues. And at the same time, you know, he said as well that he is going to be he was going to be making the announcement today, but he decided to hold off and make the announcement on Twitter. And now he says officially he's going to be making the announcement tomorrow. So when we look at kind of the differences in the two, let's look back on what Bill O'Reilly said when he asked Donald Trump if he would go to Congress and get a declaration of war. And here is Trump's response to Fox's Bill O'Reilly.
I would. This is war. If you look at it, this is war coming from all different parts. And frankly, it's war, and we're dealing with people without uniforms. You know, in the old days, we'd have uniforms. You knew what you were fighting. These people, we're allowing people into our country who we have no idea where they are, where they're from, who they are. They have no paperwork. They have no documentation in many cases.
And here is Hillary Clinton last night on CNN with Anderson Cooper.
It's clear we are at war with these terrorist groups and what they represent. It's a different kind of war, and we need to be smart about how we wage it and win it.
So here we are again with the candidates trying to figure out how to make the case that they are the best candidate to deal with the issue of terrorism, if in fact this was terrorism in Nice, France. Whose message is resonating more? I'd like to hear from both of you on that, Rebecca and Jesse.
Well, here's the thing. It's easy for political candidates to talk about war. It always becomes different when you become the president. Historically, Republicans are usually seen as being better on military and defense issues than Democrats. But this is a completely different type of election year. So who knows what the American voter is going to say in the end. But usually when it comes to national defense and military issues, Republicans are seen to be better at it by the American public. But once again, we've all seen that this is an unusual election year, so we'll have to see what the polls say about it.
Yeah, Rebecca, what do you think about that? Because, you know, just over a month ago, we were talking about Orlando. The candidates were chiming in on that. There's been Dallas. We've had the crisis with the police shooting in Minnesota. And, you know, at a certain point, do these conversations remain constructive with these politicians as they're trying to make their case here?
Well, you certainly have two very differing approaches here, both of the candidates reacting very quickly to the situation in Nice, and Donald Trump with more of a tough response, Hillary Clinton speaking about the need to kind of pursue more military intelligence and other avenues along those lines. When you talk about the way that the public perceives these two candidates, Jesse's absolutely right in that this is an election that's very different from any other election. In that, in some polls, you see Hillary Clinton has an advantage when it comes to who would best handle kind of diplomatic relations with the world, American foreign policy. You look at other polls, and Donald Trump has occasionally an advantage, a small advantage, when it comes to who would be best in control after a terror attack. Who would you want to be at the helm? But that's not by no means universal. And the polls have been all over the place, kind of depending on the time of month and the events that immediately preceded the taking of that poll. So it's still unclear. And I think one of the things that people are going to look for is when they both get on the same debate stage and are asked foreign policy questions, that you have that contrast directly in front of you.
Well, that will be interesting to see. But lost in all of this was another big announcement on Tuesday. Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton finally at a rally in New Hampshire. Here's Sanders.
While Donald Trump is busy insulting Mexicans and Muslims and women and African Americans and our veterans, Hillary Clinton understands that our diversity is one of our greatest strengths.
Jesse, this took a while, but was it a convincing endorsement to you?
Well, the Clinton camp will tell you that they would wish that Bernie Sanders had done that earlier. But from the point where it became clear that Clinton was going to win the Democratic presidential nomination, the Bernie Sanders endorsement became less and less important. He may have actually waited too long to endorse her to maximize the power he had earlier in the race. So Bernie Sanders supporters, some of whom will never vote for Hillary Clinton no matter what he says, the ones who would, I think they started moving toward Hillary Clinton once she won California. So his endorsement didn't move them. Now, did it move the ones who said, I will never vote for Hillary Clinton? It may have moved some of them, but I'm pretty sure it didn't move all of them.
Well, for those who were not necessarily moved, including young voters, I mean, Hillary Clinton really needs the young voter. Sanders is much more popular than she was with the younger ones. Can she appeal to them? And is she making any kind of overtures to them now that seem to be successful?
Well, one of the things that we are seeing is that the Bernie Sanders relationship with the young voters is kind of being taken over by Elizabeth Warren. She's going out there making some of the same arguments that Bernie Sanders was making, and she's saying Hillary Clinton is the person who can bring this to you. So the position that Bernie Sanders was taking in the Republican Party, pushing Hillary Clinton to the left, we're seeing Elizabeth Warren taking that spot, and maybe she's going to bring those voters who were riding along with Bernie Sanders over to the Clinton side.
Rebecca, does Donald Trump appeal to the young voter?
And I think, you know, one of the things you have to note is that if young voters have a choice between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, if they're young Democratic voters, we've seen that in general, many of them prefer Bernie Sanders. But when they have the choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton has a clear advantage. I think one of the big surprises for some people, by no means everyone, but for some people has been the speed with which Bernie Sanders voters have coalesced around Hillary Clinton. Now, the polls make it clear they are not terribly enthusiastic voters, many of them. Some of them are. But, you know, in general, some of them have reservations. But you look and you're seeing polls suggesting 85% support, 90% support for Hillary Clinton. Not only is this very quick, it's actually a higher level of support than Clinton voters ever registered for Barack Obama in 2008. Yeah. So we're seeing the party kind of uniting. And one of those reasons is Sanders voters do not find Donald Trump very appealing.
Well, we've got just a few seconds left, but I want to mark the occasion to say that the conventions are upon us. Robin is there as we speak in Cleveland getting ready for the GOP convention there. I'll be leaving right after the show. Just your thoughts, each of you. Rebecca, first of all, what do you expect from this convention? I think it's going to be a pretty interesting one, to say the least.
And I think that that's what we're going to have to expect, the unexpected. No one knows what to expect, not even members of the RNC.
And Jesse, what about you? Thoughts, concerns, predictions for the conventions?
This will be Donald Trump's chance to prove that he can be the standard bearer for the entire Republican Party. This will not be a place where he can go rogue. He can say what he wants. We'll see a much more reserved Donald Trump trying to convince the entire GOP that he can represent them as a whole.
Big questions about security as well in both Cleveland and Philadelphia after the attacks in Dallas and Nice now. Jesse Holland is race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press, and Rebecca Sinderbrand, politics news editor for The Washington Post. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
5G wireless service could be coming your way soon, thanks in part to the Federal Communications Commission. The FCC voted yesterday on a plan for the developing technology, making the United States the first country to set aside airwaves specifically for 5G. FCC Chair Tom Wheeler spoke last month about the need for 5G to grow and develop, eventually allowing businesses to prosper.
The future has a way of inventing itself. Turning innovators loose is far preferable to expecting committees and regulators to define the future.
Mike Regan is a columnist with Bloomberg Gadfly, and is here to explain some of the details. Mike, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
Okay, so let's start with just a definition. What is 5G? When I look at my phone, I sometimes see a little 3G or 4G in the left-hand corner. But what is it, and what is the FCC doing about it?
Well, you know, much like this show, it's all about the magic of radio waves. And 5G stands for the fifth generation of wireless technology. And what it does, it will take advantage of radio waves on the high frequency spectrum, range of the spectrum. And they allow data to move much faster and in much larger amounts. It was impractical to use them previously because transmissions would be interrupted easily by things like walls or the rain. But engineers have really worked out a lot of the bugs and are now at the point where it can be used a lot more practically.
So, yeah, how close are we to having this happen? And is the U.S. really at the vanguard here?
Well, Verizon actually had a statement out recently saying that they plan to deploy 5G as early as next year. Mm-hmm. But most people don't think it'll really be built out and in use until 2020. The question is how soon there will be products on the market to take advantage of it. But it's really going to be a hyper-competitive atmosphere to get the networks up and running and to get products out there using it.
Hyper-competitive because there is a lot at stake. There's talk that 5G will be at least 10 times and maybe up to 100 times faster than what we have now. I mean, I don't even know how to wrap my head around 100 times faster than what we have now. So you can imagine that businesses all over the place are going to want to jump into this. What does it mean for them?
Absolutely. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler actually demonstrated it earlier this year. He controlled an excavator to move dirt that was more than 1,000 miles away. And you hear talk of it being used for things like remote surgery, factory robotics, lightning fast video downloads, anything that really depends on what they call low latency, which is, you know, shrinking the amount of time it takes to move data around.
Well, so that's businesses. What about just you and me using our cell phones?
Well, it's really, you know, up to the imagination of all the engineers and developers out there. People are talking about things like obviously faster broadband, especially for the the Internet of Things, which is in the future, there's this idea that everything in your house will be connected to the Internet, from your refrigerator and your home air conditioning. Even your dog could have something on it that you can track it over the Internet.
Oh, I could use that, let me tell you. But that's a whole nother story. Well, listen, Mike, when you're talking about this sort of technology, it is hard to really to wrap your head around to understand exactly what 5G means. But it sounds like we're getting close to learning. Mike Regan, columnist with Bloomberg Gadfly. Thanks for your time, Mike.
Thank you.
Police in Arizona have released a composite sketch of a man believed to be a serial killer in Phoenix. Police say the man is responsible for what was first thought to be 4 and now is as many as 8 shooting incidents that took place from March to June of this year. Joining us now is Matt Casey. He's a reporter with Here and Now contributor KJZZ, and he's been covering this story. Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
And what do we know so far about these shootings?
Well, Phoenix police say there have been 8 incidents. 7 people are dead. 2 received non-life-threatening injuries. It's a weird situation because they came out in June and said, well, we think these 4 incidents may be related. And they didn't use the word serial shooter, or the term that they're using now is serial street shooter. This week they come out and they say, not only do we now know that these incidents are all related, there's 4 more that we want you to know about. So for the first time this week, they used the word serial street shooter. And for the first time this week, they said they were positive that these incidents are all related.
Is there any pattern to what's going on here? It seems like it's indiscriminate. You know, you've got someone just shooting at people, often late at night, right in front of their homes.
Police haven't given a whole lot of information about that. What they have said is that they have forensically linked the shootings together. The victims, there's not a real pattern there either. They range in age from 12 to 55. The first incidents that were identified happened in Maryvale, which is a West Phoenix suburb, a very diverse area. This week, when they announced that they had linked 4 more shootings to this suspect, 2 of those were east of Maryvale, 1 near the airport, 1 near downtown, and 2 were further west.
So, Matt, can you tell us about this neighborhood of Maryvale? This is in the western part of the city. As you said, it's diverse, it's low income. It was crushed during the housing crisis of 2008 and 2009. This is a neighborhood that's seen a lot of hard times.
Well, actually, Maryvale started out as kind of a symbol of post-World War II suburbia. But 2 things changed the demographics of the neighborhood. One was when they expanded Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport, and they essentially forced people who lived in a lot of traditionally Hispanic neighborhoods, they relocated to Maryvale. The other thing was the influx of immigrants. So it's a very diverse community, but people there are pretty tight-knit. And I was out to a vigil a couple weeks ago. People are watching each other's back. They're looking out for each other. The other night I was at a meeting, a different kind of community police meeting in Maryvale, and the shootings only came up twice.
What else are the police doing to find this person, and how are they making sure that the community feels safe actually just stepping outside of their own homes?
The police have been very, very active in asking people for help. They've said, you know, call us not only if you see something suspicious, but if you see something unfamiliar, call us and give us a chance to come out and check it out. People are aware. I wouldn't say that they're cowering in their homes or afraid inside their homes. People are aware of what's going on. And it's kind of weird because, like I said, they identified a cluster of incidents at first. Now, retroactively, they've added 4 more, that 2 of which went back a month before the originals.
This has some echoes of past serial shootings in Phoenix. I mean, just a few months ago, police were looking for someone who was shooting at cars on the interstates through town. Any connections there, or are people feeling like this is deja vu all over again?
Not that I've heard. The I-10 shooting incidents happened last year. There haven't been any official announcements of more incidents in that investigation. One thing that it does sound a little bit like is what they call the serial shooters, Dale Hausner and Samuel Deaton, who kind of drove around shooting at animals, people, pretty much anything indiscriminately. Those guys were arrested back in 2006. Dale Hausner committed suicide in prison on death row, and I believe Samuel Deatman is still in prison.
KJZZ's Matt Casey has been following the story of another serial shooter in Phoenix that police say has killed 7 people since the shootings began in March. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
As Cleveland gets ready to kick off the Republican National Convention, the city's marking the 50th anniversary of an event that put it in the national spotlight, the Huff Riots. The riots lasted a week, and the violence has come to symbolize the social disparities of a segregated city. But some people in Cleveland remember those dark days differently, as a time when local teenagers, black and white, came together over their love of music. David C. Barnett of Here and Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream takes us to the East Side Club in Cleveland, where it all happened, a place called Leo's Casino.
As CEO of the Urban League of Greater Cleveland, Marsha Mockabee focuses on such heady issues as workforce development and economic empowerment. But mention Leo's Casino, and she's a teenager again.
My first trip there was at 16. I won the dinner with the Temptations. They took us to Leo's Casino and brought us on stage and sang My Girl to us. I've got sunshine. I was the most popular girl in my high school for about a week.
Sitting in a suburban cafe, Ruthie Brown recalls it was a girlfriend who got her to go to Leo's for the first time.
She says, we're going to go to this club that everybody goes to.
The former community relations director at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Brown says Motown Records chief Barry Gordy was a canny businessman who used Leo's Casino as a test market. The rhythm and blues music that his groups recorded was sold to both African-American and white teens under the racially neutral banner of The Sound of Young America.
Barry Gordy used Cleveland as sort of like a template for hits. If it was a hit in Cleveland, it was going to be a hit nationally.
Leo's Casino originally opened as a jazz venue in the 1950s. It was part of a musical tradition called Black and Tan Clubs, bars that attracted both black and white audiences. Ernie Krivda recalls being part of a wave of new listeners.
My generation of young suburban kids going into the inner city to check out the music.
A budding saxophonist, Krivda was eventually hired as a regular local sideman to the many Motown groups that passed through the packed club.
I mean, everybody dug it. They were sharing the love for this newly sophisticated pop music, which Motown was. And Leo's was bringing them in.
One of Motown's top acts, The Supremes, was finishing up a six-night stand at Leo's on July 19, 1966, when they became a part of Cleveland history. Several blocks away, an outbreak of fires and looting spread along Huff Avenue. Historian John Grabowski traces it to a pattern of poverty and discrimination that simmered in the neighborhood for years.
Which sets off what some of my colleagues would call not a riot, but a rebellion against the conditions. And that's just north of Leo's.
Ruthie Brown says there were National Guard units rolling past the club towards the disturbance. One guardsman was surprised to find a concert in full swing when he walked in the front door.
The National Guard person comes on and says, this place is closed. Do you see those tanks outside? There's a riot going on. They had to make the people go home.
Over the next week, the neighborhood was shut down. For a musician like Ernie Krivda, the violent nights in Huff damaged more than buildings.
That whole East Side music thing took a big hit, as far as I'm concerned. It was sad.
He says a week of disturbances led to years of fear and suspicion between whites and blacks in that East Side music scene in Cleveland. Area clubs were shuttered as audiences disappeared. Leo's Casino did reopen a few weeks after the riots and stayed in business for about another 6 years or so, but things had changed. John Grabowski says the once thriving music scene had withered.
But nevertheless, I don't think that negates the symbolic and actual importance of something like Leo's Casino, where you had black entertainers coming in and a white audience and a black audience sharing space.
In an era when modern music clubs regularly draw multicultural crowds, it may be hard to imagine a time when racial mixing was rare. But one of the seeds for today's diversity was planted at a place that offered an alternative to the segregated world outside. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Listening to Here and Now.
Late last night, as people in Nice, France, were celebrating Bastille Day, a local man drove a truck down a major thoroughfare, mowing down hundreds of people in his path. At least 84 have died, more than 200 are injured. We're learning today that the driver has Tunisian roots. No organization has claimed responsibility, but French prosecutors say it has the hallmarks of a terrorist attack. Now, horrific events like this always raise the same question: could it have been prevented? And to help us answer that, we're joined by Daniel Linsky. He's managing director at the security company Kroll. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this was a huge event in Nice. People all over the place. Are we trying to contain the uncontainable?
Well, we're going to have huge events. We're going to have marathons like we had in Boston. We're going to have our July 4th celebration. Events are going to continue to go on. We need to look at what risk we have to those events and then figure out what we can do to minimize the chances of someone conducting an attack. And if they do conduct an attack, how can we minimize the damage that they can do?
Well, one of the risks, obviously, was that a truck could be used to mow people down. There is technology available to limit something like that.
Sure. It could be as simply as a police car parked across the street or a cement truck with sand. As you see, when the president comes to town, we usually have the approach routes covered with those vehicles, concrete barriers. There's a lot of things that could have been put in place that would have prevented vehicular traffic from interacting with that crowd.
You think they could have worked in this situation? We don't even know if they were there.
I don't know the layout of the land. They might have had that. That might have been the queue area that people were going into to go for the celebration. The challenge is, no matter what you do, at some point there's always a vulnerability, and your enemy is going to try and use that vulnerability against you when they can.
Well, you were with the Boston Police Department during the marathon bombings 3 years ago now. We know the story well. Two local men walked to the finish line, planted homemade bombs. Have we learned any lessons from that event that are used today?
We've had a great security plan and a strong security plan during the marathon before the bombing attack, and we've made that plan stronger. And we can put more checkpoints. We can put more concentric circles of security out there, more officers. We can do better training of our officers to make sure that they're trained in what they need to be, whether that's bomb detection with the special trained EOD canines, or is it behavioral detection analysis, where you look at people as they're entering into an area for a large-scale event, and you're looking at the behavior. Does it look like someone who's excited to be coming to the event? Does it look like someone who's running late for meeting somebody? Or does it look like somebody who's nervous and evil intent? Jeff Bauman, during the marathon bombing, when he was had the tube taken out of his mouth. One of the victims who lost both legs. As soon as he was able to speak on his own, the first thing he said is, "I saw who did it." He saw Tim Lindsayniv arrive. He saw his body language. He knew he was up to no good. And before he could do anything about it, the explosion went off.
The trouble is, every circumstance, every attack is different. Here's a clip from one eyewitness to the attack in Nice. He wonders if these kind of things could be stopped.
We've been living with a state of emergency since the November attacks. So we see police walking around, we see armed soldiers walking around the railway stations and the airports and so on. I don't know to what extent our armed soldiers could actually prevent. Armed soldiers can't open fire when there's a crowd.
Your thought, the role of armed soldiers.
We don't know how many attacks those soldiers prevented by being present, visible, and interacting with the community. We don't know how many attacks were thwarted by the police working with the community to get information on individuals before they could conduct an attack. It's impossible to tell what you prevented. Can armed soldiers respond? The only response to that last night is somebody getting a shot at that driver and stopping him. You're going to need somebody there with a weapon and somebody there who can take that shot.
Well, we're all thinking about the conventions coming up, the political conventions. We have big reason to think there's going to be lots of protests. We've seen protests turn violent in Dallas recently in this country. What about that, these political conventions where a whole part of a city is cordoned off? The security is definitely in place. Are those easier to secure, or do they have weaknesses as well?
everything has strengths and weaknesses. And, you know, the inner area where the president, presidential nominees are going to be, that's going to be a secured area, the Secret Service. By the time you get there, you've gone through 8, 10, 12 layers of security. They're going to have emergency action plans. That's going to be a very secure area with credentialed people only. The area around it, the protest zones, might not be as secured. And we had a very huge security presence during the 2004 Democratic National Convention. We were expecting large problems. We were expecting large protests. We were expecting large concerns. The city was vacant. A lot of people left, took their vacation that week. And the industry around the city said that it was kind of the slowest time they ever had in that period. So you don't know exactly what you're going to get. I think we're going to have some protests definitely in Cleveland. There's definitely individuals who are out broadcasting. They intend to be there protesting. And managing their protest crowds are a unique challenge that's growing even more challenging every day.
And one of the things here in this situation, you hear this often when people are in one of these attacks, they don't really know what's going on. You know, they were at a fireworks display. Someone says, I thought they were fireworks. Or you hear guns go off and you think it's a backfiring car. So this is very complicated. And what to do as a person who's attending one of these events will have to be a conversation for another time. But we've been speaking with Daniel Linsky. He's managing director at the security company Kroll. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.